This nation was founded on the principle that all men are created equal.
We hold these truths to be self-evident.
That all men are created equal.
I'll tell you what freedom is to me. No fear. I mean, really, no fear.
Created equal.
From WDET in Detroit, this is Created Equal. I'm Stephen Henderson, and I'm in the studio with Carey Jr. II. He's our show producer.
How you doing, Stephen? I'm excited to talk about another audio show, an audio program or series, podcast, however you want to call it, on the show.
Someone who does work that's somewhat similar to what on Created Equal. This is part of our series that's taking a look at winners of the 2024 Pulitzer Prizes. This one was a winner for audio reporting, and it's a really interesting look back at a hate crime in Chicago from almost 30 years ago.
Yep, it's called You Didn't See Nothing. It was produced by the Invisible Institute and hosted by Johannes LaCour. Johannes joins us on the show, and it centers around, as you said, an attack from about 30 years ago, centered in 1990. It occurred in 1997 in Chicago. A 13-year-old black boy, Leonard, is jumped and attacked by some boys for being in the wrong neighborhood. He's put in a coma. And this retelling kind of becomes less about the attack itself and more about how the public and the media respond.
Yeah. And there is this effort, this contortionist almost effort, to make this about something other than consequences and accountability for the people who committed the crime, and facing up to the racism that fueled that crime, and instead becomes this effort to focus on peace and getting along, something that I think has resonance in today's discussion about inequality and about policing and about violence. It's from almost 30 years ago, but many of the things that surface could be true in 2024. Johannes LaCour, welcome to Created Equal.
Thank you, thank you.
So I want to start here with a little scene setting. Most people, I think, who are not from Chicago or never lived there, don't know about Chicago and neighborhoods and ethnicity and race. So tell us about Bridgeport in Chicago and what it was like in the late 1990s. This, of course, is the backdrop that colors the subject of your podcast.
Sure. So Bridgeport, especially in the late 1990s, it was what I often refer to as a sundown town of a neighborhood in the middle of the south side of Chicago. Bridgeport was primarily Italian and Irish, and very known racist. Black folks knew not to go there. It was just like a matter of unwritten law.
One of the ironies, I think, about that is that this is not just some random neighborhood in the city. This is the neighborhood that the Daleys, Richard J. Daley, and then his son, Richard M. Daley, who both become mayors of Chicago, they're from there.
Yes, they're from there, and pretty much the entire political machine is from there. Most police officers are from there. That is the center of the city politically. And so so it's a lot of power there. And so the racism that went on there was kind of carried out with impunity. I just got a message yesterday from a woman whose cousin was killed in Bridgeport in the 80s. And nothing was ever done about it. That was a regular thing. And yeah, so that power that sat there in the middle of Bridgeport, it protected its home.
So let's talk then about Leonard Clark and why he found himself in Bridgeport.
So Leonard Clark was, one of the first really warm days. It was like early in spring, as a matter of fact, unseasonably warm day. And, you know, after a long, long, hard winter, especially with Chicago was even more used to back then, those first warm days, people trying to get outside. And so he's 13 years old, and he's going outside with his friend, and they're on their bicycles, and he has a flat tire on his bicycle. And so he walks to the gas station in Bridgeport. The gas station in Bridgeport, the air is free, but it costs a quarter in his neighborhood in the projects, which is already an interesting schism. He's in the projects, and air costs. And in Bridgeport, working class community that's home of the mayor and countless city workers, the air is free, but costs a quarter where he lives in the projects. And so, when he's going to get air, he is spotted by some older Bridgeport teenagers. They're like 19 and 20. He's 13. So they're young adults, and he's barely a teenager. And he's attacked and beaten into a coma.
And he's beaten for no reason other than the fact that he's there, right?
Oh, no. They actually, I don't know what type of language you allow, but it was reported that the ringleader of the attack, uh-huh, who spotted him while driving, said that they wanted to get the nigger out of the neighborhood.
And these aren't just any attackers either, right? These are not just random attackers. They have some significance in the neighborhood and in the city. Talk about who they were.
Right. So the ringleader of the attack, who's driving around his neighborhood with a couple of his buddies when he spots Lenard Clark and his friend, happens to be the son of a very powerfully mob connected union leader, and for all practical purposes, a mob leader himself, a local mob leader himself in Chicago. Frank Caruso Jr. was the attacker, and he's the son of Frank Caruso, who was an Italian-American longtime Bridgeport resident, whose mob ties literally go back to Al Capone.
And why does that matter in this case? Again, I think for people who are not from Chicago, don't live there, it's not always clear. What does that actually end up meaning?
The reason that's so relevant is because Bridgeport, while it's the home of the dailies and the political machine and so many of the police officers in Chicago, it's also the home of a lot of Chicago's crime families. And so you got, this alliance, and it's a familial alliance. I mean, they're all from the same place, they're the same folks. And so now you got, the mob and the police all together. And so, first of all, they're protected by way of being from Bridgeport's own. They're protected because of the relationship between the local government and the police and the mayors. But then they're also a part of the mob, which offers another kind of protection. And the mob at this point, being so entrenched in the unions, have kind of, their power now overlaps, right? So you got mobsters in government as well. And so, when this kid, when Lenard Clark is beaten into a coma, and these mob kids are a few of them are eventually caught for it, these powerfully connected mob families of theirs go to great lengths to protect them and to keep them out of jail. And so, now we're talking about folks with the ability to leverage power on the streets, politically paying folks off the whole nine, and worse. There's a there was a murder of a witness related to this hate crime, to this beating, that that many believe, myself included, was murdered.
Murdered as a way to derail the investigation into what happened, right? Yeah. I want to Talk about the police response to this as well. You know, as you point out, this happens in a neighborhood that has this political history and is kind of this anchor of political power in the city. The crime is committed by a person with mob ties and political ties. But how do the police themselves respond to this? How do they play all the dynamics here and figure out what to do?
So what I know and what I discovered from a woman who named Pat Hill, may she rest in power. She passed years ago. She was the president of the African American Police League. And this was an interesting time because this was a time when, you know, you had an African-American police league that ran counter to police culture, right? And you know, Pat Hill was dedicated to fighting for African-American police and to actually hold police accountable. She wrote a book called Black Ain't Blue. She was an advocate of the people as a police officer. Mm-hmm. You just don't see that anymore. And what she told me was that her sources told her police officers who were on duty in the station the night that these Italian boys were brought in for this crime, that the mob lawyers and families essentially took the station over. And police kind of allowed the Carusos and their lawyers and legal team free reign of the station in a manner that they'd never seen done before. So the police kind of, you know, in a certain kind of way, kind of fell back and allowed their mob-connected friends and relatives and neighbors to handle a lot of this, a lot of the case. They did not aggressively, and as was customary in Bridgeport, when crimes occur against black folks, racist crimes occur in Bridgeport against black folks, justice was not aggressively sought because the perpetrators were the relatives and friends and neighbors of the police.
And in fact, the title of your podcast sort of speaks to the kind of ostriching that goes on hereafter. You didn't see nothing.
Right. So when the police show up at the scene of the crime, there was a young man who called the police, a Bridgeport resident who had recently moved to Bridgeport. So he wasn't a native and he wasn't a part of the racist Bridgeport culture. I believe he wasn't even from Chicago, and he moved to Bridgeport, apparently not mm-hmm. knowing Bridgeport's, you know, racial history and its notoriety for being a sundown town in the middle of a huge city. And he calls the police, and so when the police arrive, you know, it's a bunch of, because it happened, Lennar wound up being chased and stomped nearly to death. He was on life support. He was in a coma for days. Didn't even know he was going to make it. And it happened right outside of a popular local mm-hmm. Bridgeport dive. I think it was called Jimbo's. And so all of the, you know, Bridgeport residents who've been in there drinking and hanging out or whatever, they come out and they start mm-hmm. telling the police it was Mexicans that did it. You know, so these are Bridgeport residents, adults, obviously coming out of a bar, who are basically covering these youngsters and trying to, you know, help get these. It's a neighborhood wide effort to save these boys and from punishment for beating this black boy into a coma. And so, but the one resident who did call the police is like, no, you know, it wasn't a Mexican. He starts to tell the police what he saw, and somebody from the crowd is like, you didn't see nothing. And it was understood that that was a threat, it was understood that, you know, just shut up, you know, get with the program. And yeah, it turned into a perfect title as well.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, we need to take a quick break. And when we come back, we're going to continue this conversation with Johannes LaCour about his podcast, You Didn't See Nothing. We'll be right back with more Created Equal. Back with more Created Equal from WDET in Detroit. I'm Stephen Henderson, and I'm really glad you're with us. Our guest today is Johannes LaCour. He's a journalist and host of a podcast titled You Didn't See Nothing. It was a 2024 Pulitzer Prize winner in the audio reporting category. It is about a young African-American man in Chicago in 1997 who goes into the Bridgeport neighborhood, which is a white ethnic neighborhood on the city's south side, and is beaten into a coma. Johannes, I want to start this part of the conversation talking about the wider response to what happens to Leonard Clark. And I guess the best way for me to kind of summarize that or frame that is that there seems to be this effort to keep peace or to find peace, but not to pursue justice, right? And I think in the language and the narrative of civil rights and work around equality, there's always kind of a tension between those two things, right? Some people want peace, other people want justice, and often we don't get both. This seems like a very strong example of peace being the priority and justice kind of taking a back seat.
Absolutely. You know, so one on the mention is it's just important that we stress that Leonard Clark was 13 years old,
mm-hmm.
right? So a lot of times, you know, when we describe him as a young man, it can be lost on folks what the age difference was here and what the power dynamic was. You know, he was 13, and if, you know, if anything, his attackers were young men.
Yeah.
So, you know, there's been a long time, you know, and very few people have not heard the chant, no justice, no peace.
Right.
It's generally protesters' way of saying, we are going to protest and disturb the peace until we have justice. And it's like human nature, you know, closed mouth doesn't get fed, right? Babies cry and make a bunch of noise when they, you know, are hungry and are, you know, needing food and sustenance. And so you got, you know, generally as black folks in this country, we have often found ourselves with the no justice, no peace rally cry, because that is disturbing the peace has been the only effective way of getting the system to pay attention to our needs mm-hmm. as we pursue justice. And so similarly, in this case, after Leonard Clark was found damn near dead in a coma as a result of this attack by these, you know, older young men from Bridgeport, it went up. People started protesting, marching, rallying. People were incensed. I often tell people that this was like the Trayvon Martin of mm-hmm. Chicago in the 90s, but without social media. And thank God for Leonard Clark. He wasn't killed. He survived.
Right.
But it was that big a case. It was huge. It you know, it was the heater case that summer. And in those protests and marches and calls for justice, almost, you know, with the exception of just a small handful of good folk, those calls for justice died and just went silent. And many of the people calling for justice, some of the loudest advocates, you know, for these rallies, actually didn't just go quiet. They went contrary.
Right. And they flipped sides, right?
Yeah, exactly. And they started calling for peace. They didn't just stop saying, you know, no justice, no peace. They went fully opposite and started calling for peace and not justice, and started to claim that justice would be to allow these boys to walk and allow these boys to not, you know, to not be pursued in the court of law. And that is what was most frustrating and flabbergasting about the whole situation.
It's the Caruso family. This is the family of the lead attacker, I guess, against Lenard Clark, that exerts the pressure, really, to change this narrative, and to make it about peace and people getting along rather than accountability for what happened. Talk about what they did, and as you point out earlier, who they enlist to help them do that.
So it's important that I do say that a lot of this is still alleged. A lot of this, you know, has not been proven in a court of law, right? And but a lot of this is what was relayed to me from Pat Hill, who was had deep ties to the community and got a lot of information. But at the time, so Pat Hill, being a police officer, active at the time, black police officer, she told me a lot of this stuff in secrecy. And the reason I share it now and have shared it in the podcast since is because she has unfortunately passed. And then when she told it to me in secrecy, she told me that, you know, this is the type of stuff that she could be killed for. That because she was telling me things that the police were allowing, mob connected folks to get away with. And so what she told me was that the Carusos had created a list of folks in the community to pay, basically in return for silence. And there were checks being given out. And so, there were several folks in the community who had probably been the loudest. And there were folks with whom the Carusos had been in bed with prior, just around union dealings, right? So you got black folks. And this is another thing, right? Like, some of these black men who they were able to, who it seems they were able to pay off, to kind of be silent about this whole thing. It's not like they hadn't, you know, they're human, so it's not like they hadn't done good and great work prior. Some of these men had fought pretty hard to get jobs for black folks, especially with unions.
Yeah.
And so in those efforts, they developed relationships with these mob-connected union bosses, to funnel jobs into the black community. And so the Carusos relied on those relationships and called on those folks to do some favors for them. And in this particular, you know, return of favor was to kind of silence their constituents and kind of change this call for justice and call for prison time for these young Bridgeport men into a call for leniency and forgiveness, which was just ridiculous and offensive.
Yeah. There's a black minister who is involved with this and who helps the Caruso family change this narrative. Talk about who this is and what role he plays.
Right. So B. Herbert Martin, Reverend B. Herbert Martin, he went so far as to say and suggest that the police had the wrong men and that Frank Caruso Jr. wasn't even a part of it, which was interesting because you're pushing for reconciliation and forgiveness while suggesting that these folks ain't even guilty of nothing. Who are we forgiving? It was just a asinine, absurd ask and call to action that Reverend Martin was making. And so, yeah, he had the Carusos, come and speak at his church and called for services. And, I think it was Martin Luther King that talked about, just how segregated America is on Sunday morning. Mm-hmm. He's the preacher of a black church that I'm pretty sure had little to zero Bridgeport residents in his congregation. In Bridgeport churches, you can imagine, were black free. And now, he was, Reverend Martin was creating services, busing folks from Bridgeport into his neighborhood and got folks joining hands in church. And Bridgeport folks are showing up. And who you think is contacting all these Bridgeport residents to show up to this black church? Mm-hmm. But these mob leaders who are trying to get their son off, and all of so much of this is for press and PR and to try to convince the general public that the Caruso boy was innocent.
Yeah. So again, this is this is happening in a city where the racial dynamics are defined by a number of different, I think, unusual characteristics, right? I mean, I'm sitting here in Detroit. We don't have anything equivalent to Bridgeport in our city, not in the city at least. We don't have a mayor who's from, a family that has had power in that city for decades and decades and comes from that neighborhood. I wonder if you can talk about what you think the fear was among the political class, in media, in the Bridgeport community, about what would happen if these attackers were just treated like any other criminal suspects, if they were just taken and put on trial for what they allegedly did, and maybe convicted and sentenced. What was the reason to not want that to happen, beyond just the individual fear that the family might have had? It seems to me that there's a community fear here that's at play.
I think it was about who had money and power and who didn't, and who was depending on who for it, right? I don't think that these black folks that sided with the Carusos trying to keep this young man out of jail were necessarily afraid something would happen to them as much. I don't think it got. I don't imagine it got to that point. It feels to me that, all right, so the young man is facing jail time for this attack on this little boy. And his father calls black folks who he feels can calm the rest of the community down and kind of change the narrative in the court of public opinion first. And in return for money. So I think it's more of it's not so much what do we lose if, these boys go to jail. It's what do we gain if we help them stay out of jail. And so I think it's more of a quid pro quo type of thing where it's like, we want to keep these jobs rolling. We want this you know, we want this infusion of money and these folks are going to pay to play. And I'm sure it's not lost on them that, you know, they would wind up on the Caruso's bad side if they don't play ball.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, whatever that may have meant to them, I mean, could they have potentially been afraid, like, damn, if we don't play ball here and we stand firm, like, nah, we're not, you know, accepting money and favor in return for selling this kid out, what might happen to us? Might we be attacked or in danger because the mob is obviously violent and will go to, you know, desperate lengths to cover that?
Mm-hmm.
That's very possible.
Yeah.
But I don't imagine they were ever threatened and made to feel fearful of what would happen if they didn't do it. I think that the relationships between these black folks and the Crusoes were already such that it was more like calling a favor in.
Yeah.
And paying for
there was a benefit. There was a benefit, exactly, for what they were doing. Yeah.
Exactly.
So let's talk about what happens though to the attackers. What were the consequences here?
First of all, I got every reason to believe there were actually six attackers, mm-hmm, at least,
mm-hmm,
and only three were arrested. The ringleader, again, the young man who was Frank Caruso Jr., he wound up doing about 2 years when all was said and done.
Mm-hmm.
And the other two wound up doing no jail time. A slap on the wrist at best. For a hate crime that left a 13-year-old in a coma, changed his life.
And this is just because prosecutors don't charge more aggressively, and in at least one case, the jury doesn't or the judge doesn't believe that someone ought to go to jail.
No, the judge in the original case sentenced Caruso to like 8 years.
Mm-hmm.
But they came back and gave him some sort of good time and ran him some probation, and he wound up just doing 2 years.
Yeah. Okay, we're going to take another quick break, and when we come back, we'll continue this conversation with Johannes LaCour about his podcast, You Didn't See Nothing. We'll be right back with more Created Equal. Back with more Created Equal from WDET in Detroit. I'm Stephen Henderson, and thanks for joining. Our guest is Johannes LaCour. He is a journalist and host of a podcast titled You Didn't See Nothing. It is the 2024 Pulitzer Prize winner in audio reporting. Johannes, I want to talk about the fact that you were able to talk with Lenard Clark about what happened to him. And before that, he isn't someone who has spoken a whole lot about this attack. Why do you think he was comfortable talking for this project?
So when I started pursuing this story, I spoke to Lenard Clark off the record to introduce myself.
Mm-hmm.
And a mutual friend put me in tune with him, and he agreed to sit down with me. Let him know that, you know, back when this happened to him, I was driven to report about it, and I was frustrated by it, and that I was returning to kind of revisit the case. He did not agree to talk to me for the podcast once he realized that this was, I basically, that I was a journalist And I started asking him if we could record. Mm-hmm. He was actually not willing to do that. I fortunately have a friend who I met in prison who was who grew up in the same projects that Lenard grew up in, who knew him and knew me, mm-hmm. and could vouch for me and let Lenard know that I wasn't another media vulture or somebody trying to sensationalize his case or you know, someone in for a quick payday or something. He'd been used and handled, you know, by a lot of folks as a result of this case. And so what he did was he spoke to my friend Hot Rod, is what we call him, Rodney Phillips, and he spoke to Hot Rod and on the record for the podcast.
And you were able to use that, right?
Yes, and we
You said that he had been treated badly or wrongly before by people. In this case, talk about what that looked like. What kinds of things had happened to him? People sensationalizing his case after all this happened.
He and his family felt used.
Yeah.
By some of the people who'd been using them because they'd been bought off by the Carusos. I mean, he was 13 at the time, and he was in a coma, and he's learning how to walk again and talk again. And as he is, he is, and his family are slowly discovering that they're being manipulated by folks who are operating pretty much at the command and on the dime of his attacker's family. And so, you know, Lenard even said, you know, on the record to Hot Rod in the podcast that he doesn't trust people anymore, doesn't even like people. And so it was these kind of experiences that left him understandably reluctant and ultimately unwilling to go on the record with folks he didn't know.
Yeah. Yeah. So I also want to have you talk just a bit about why you tell this story like a memoir. What went into that choice?
Well, you know, when I first came home, I was just looking to do some writing, man, just put some money in my pocket. And so Jamie Calvin, the Invisible Institute, the journalism organization that I produce this with here in Chicago, initially gave me a fellowship to tell this story. And the idea was going to be a written piece, long form journalism. And it was a challenge to get that done. And so around the same time, the audio team with the Invisible Institute had just wrapped up their first podcast. And it was very successful. A podcast called Somebody, Pulitzer Prize nominee, amazing podcast. And so it was actually Jamie Calvin that suggested that, you know, telling this story through my personal lens, of having, you know, jumped on it in 97 when it happened and then reflecting on it, you know, 25 years later, but fresh off of 10 years just away from society, having been locked up, and then the perspective of, you know, how much had changed and how much hadn't over that time would be a really interesting framework for the podcast. And it wound up being an incredible direction.
Yeah, it's very powerful.
Yeah, thank you.
Yeah. I also wonder what you make of the difference that you just referenced, right? So what if this happened today in Chicago? What if this happened in Bridgeport today? Given all the things that have changed since 1997, and given the things that, I don't know, maybe haven't changed since 1997, do you imagine that this would look different in that city or in America?
I definitely think it would look different. And it's, you know, you got to think about it. So I've thought about this before. before. I probably asked this question. We talked about this. And you got to remember, we're at this point, we're just guessing,
right?
If it happened today, so much has changed. One of the big factors is social media.
Right.
I think that social media alone, you know, Black Twitter, and the backlash that these men who basically sold out to the Carusos would have faced. It was been too many, you know. So my reporting, for instance, my reporting went basically unheard. There were crickets. I was reporting for a very small newspaper that itself had been based out of the projects, that had a very small reach, and which was pretty much the projects in the low end in the south, on the small section of the south side of Chicago. Today, that article would have been pushed on social media, and
it would have been everywhere,
would have gone viral. Exactly. Right. There's no way that the rest of the news media would not have would have been able to turn a blind eye and look the other way at these allegations and these assertions.
Yeah.
So social media alone would have at least helped keep the narrative closer to it with more accuracy. At the same time, I think that it doesn't. You got to also understand that's not Bridgeport today,
right?
That's not the city today. It looks a lot different. Those what I often tell folks, in my opinion, the young men that left Lenard Clark in a coma would have badges, and so that type of violence between Bridgeport citizens and them, you know, the same way, you know, to go a little off key, but I'm staying in this on the same page. Michelle Alexander calls mass incarceration the new Jim Crow.
Yes.
Police officers were started as slave patrols. So everything's evolving. So Klansmen and the citizens that used to terrorize Black folks with hoods now have badges and police cars. And so in Bridgeport, a neighborhood that was already a training ground for Chicago police, has become even more so. So that type of, the youngsters who had that type of spirit, racist spirit in them, just become cops now. And so it just doesn't look the same.
I mean, that's a really powerful observation to make. Are you saying that you think because they're cops, they wouldn't have done the same thing, or that they would, and that now we'd have the added problem that it was committed by police who don't just have power, covert power, but have official power and cover to do things.
Police, just as a matter of fact, in their work, are oppressive, and so they don't sit up. Hey, there goes some Black kids. Let's beat them up. It's not that simple. They spend their entire day over policing Black communities and slamming young Black men on cars and against walls and on pavements and concrete and cuffing them too tight and abusing their rights and violating their rights, you know, day in, day out. So it's not kind of a joyride ride around my neighborhood, look for Black folks to beat up. It's like, okay, now I got a badge and I get paid to harass and you know, run through the pockets of Black men and sexually assault Black men and women all day at will. I'm not suggesting that, you know, today's, that they're just, riding around, that the attack looks the same. I'm suggesting that, you know, now we don't have to ride around and just look for something to beat up. We get paid to police them day in, day out.
Yeah, yeah. So I want to end with you talking about what you hope this work accomplishes. What do you want people to know about Chicago and about race and about America from this? But more importantly, what do you want people to do? What change do you want to affect here?
A lot of it ain't about me or Lenard Clark, and it's about Black stories.
Yeah.
And it's about the fact that, you know, I want people to pay more attention to Black storytelling. I want Black folks. I want to see more of us telling our stories. Because, you know, part of the premise that you didn't see nothing is that none of us even knew what happened for
right.
real.
Right.
And we all got the story as told to us by outsiders. The call to action would be to, if you see something, say something. Mm. Be vocal and understand what you're up against so you can best protect yourself, however that looks to you.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, as you end the podcast, you say, I saw something and now so did you.
Yeah, I think that we want to arm folks with information.
Yeah.
So that we can make better decisions, so we can, take a closer look at who's speaking for us. And again, we talk about, you know, the Black men that sold Lenard Clark out and who were bought off the, you know, flip sides and started defending his attackers. We need to be scrutinizing who we're calling leadership and why, and hold them accountable as well.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, Johannes, congratulations, of course, on the Pulitzer Prize.
Thanks.
I'm sure that was an amazing, amazing event to have happen in your life. But the work is really amazing and very deserving of it. So, thank you so much for joining us here on Created Equal.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
So, you know, listening back to this podcast and hearing Johannes talk about it, it seems like a very kind of self-aware, almost meta approach, considering it is media. And he has some really insightful, I don't know if I say criticisms, but comments about how the media responded in this sense. And overall, he really was trying to, you know, reconcile with what happened, but kind of found himself in the end of the show kind of being like, this wasn't resolved. We didn't really confront this head on as we were supposed to. And so this is his approach to confronting it.
Yeah. I mean, I think one of the things that is really interesting about this is the way it all kind of folds back over on itself.
Mm-hmm.
Johannes is telling someone else's story, but he's also telling his.
Right.
He's also working through his own feelings about how all this happened and what it meant in the city where he's from.
Yeah, I was gonna say that quote that you used at the end of the interview, Stephen, about how he didn't see nothing. He didn't see nothing. He saw something, and now you did too. I thought that was a really great way to end the show, in the series, in the podcast. So
it really was.
It took the sting away.
Ah,
so now we got to go off on me calling you out on it.
That's not as good, but it works. That'll do it for Created Equal. You can listen to recent episodes online at WDET.org. And of course, make sure to subscribe to our podcast. Created Equal is produced by Kerry Jr. II and David Lines. Our sound editing is by Connor Anderson. And our music is by Sam Bobian. Our digital team is Jenny Sherman, Dave Kim, and Sophia Joswiak. Our program director is Adam Fox. Created Equal is a production of WDET, Detroit's public radio.